Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back to All of It on WNYC. I'm Shamita Basu, filling in for Allison Stewart. When award-winning journalist and author Abby Ellen met the commander, as we'll call him, she was swept off her feet. He was a charming, successful Beverly Hills doctor who was also an ex-Navy SEAL and a high-level CIA operative who masterminded the raid on Osama bin Laden. Incredible, right? Well, apparently a little too incredible to be true. After a whirlwind romance and even an engagement, the commander's stories began to unravel, and Abby realized that her fiancé was a total fraud. In her new book, Duped, Double Lives, False Identities, and the Con Man I Almost Married, Abby explores her own experience of being deceived, as well as the phenomenon of lying, why some people lead double lives, what makes someone likely to be a victim, and the psychological toll of deception. Duped is published by Public Affairs, and I'm very happy to welcome to our studio now Abby Ellen. Hi, Abby.
Hello.
Welcome
to
All of It. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
So let's talk about this con man.
Okay.
You almost married. What were some of the claims that he told you that later you learned were not true?
Oh, God. He had told me that he met his ex-wife in Iran when he rescued her. She was held hostage, and he swooped in like Superman, and he saved the day. He told me that he had been held hostage in China and tortured mercilessly, and that is why he had to sleep with the lights on and the Food Network blaring, and, you know, and that's also why he had screaming nightmares in the middle of the night, because he still just was terrified of being in the dark. God, he told me that he worked for the CIA. He told me that he had been a Navy SEAL, that he had a vault full of medals for operations that were undercover. Everything was undercover. Nothing was verifiable.
So that's the next part I was going to ask you. Why was it so hard to verify these things? These are all super high-level sort of top-secret claims that he made. So you were willing to believe him.
To a point.
Well, this is my question for you, because, Abby, I know you're a journalist.
Yeah.
It's in your nature and in your job description to be a skeptical person. So why do you think you were willing to accept what he said and
I accepted what he said very much to a point. I was trying to be, there's a difference between being a person sometimes and being a journalist. And I kept thinking, you know, if I want to be in a relationship, I'm going to have to curb my natural skepticism. I am going to just sort of try to learn to accept things at face value. And as friends of mine would say, because I would ask them about this, I would talk to them. And my friend Jill said, you know, maybe that's the lesson. You don't have to learn, you don't have to know everything. There are things you won't know and can't know. And, you know, so maybe you don't need to question everything.
Are you saying that love interests don't always like being cross-examined?
I'm saying, you know, I have been told that I can be a little bit like a trial lawyer. I mean, that I am just this cross-examiner and I interrogate. And I know this can be very off-putting. So the commander used to get mad at me. He would say, you interrogate me, you don't trust me. Which is true. I didn't. But I wanted to. I tried to.
So tell me when the cracks first started to appear.
They started to appear. Well, I have a mother, and my mother, I was telling her the story. What had happened is that he told me that he had been the medical director at Guantanamo. And then while he was at Guantanamo, he treated very important terrorists, one of whom was Osama bin Laden. And I said to him, that is the dumbest thing I've ever heard in my life. That is insane. And I said, you know, the president would want this. This wouldn't have been able to stay secret. The president would want this to get out. And this was Bush. And he said, well, the president doesn't know. And I would say to him, I said to him, you know, that's ludicrous. That's just insane. But on the other hand, I don't know anything about this. This is not my world. I didn't know the military. I didn't know secret ops. I didn't know. I live in New York City. I'm from Brookline, Massachusetts. This wasn't my world. maybe things like this are possible. So I kind of filed it in my back pocket. And I was at Johns Hopkins. I was going to school for international relations. And I would ask my teachers there, I would say, is it possible to have medals for operations that don't exist? And they would say, absolutely. It's possible. Mm-hmm. So anytime I tried to verify, I could verify sort of to a point, but then there were, known unknowns and known knowns,
sure,
and, all of that. It was very weird. But
was
my
he
mother,
a doctor?
He really was a doctor.
Okay.
He really had been in private practice. He really was in the Navy, and he really had been at Guantanamo.
Oh, okay.
So
all
that's
right.
But that's the thing about really good liars. You mix fiction and nonfiction, and then you shoot it out of a cannon and see what lands where, And that's what he did. But the story, my mother said to me, Abby, that's not possible. There's something wrong with him. I mean, and I got so mad at her. I said, you are so suspicious. It's your fault that I don't believe. It's your fault I don't believe anybody. That's why this is my line of work. And she was like, I'm telling you, something's not right. He had also told me that when we moved to Washington, we moved into the Watergate, which is like hilarious to me because it's ground zero for deception. And he said that Plácido Domingo and William Kennedy Smith had been at the board interview. And my mother said, why would Plácido Domingo go to the board interview? Like, he's got other things to do with his time. And I remember I said to her, maybe he cares about where he lives. And she said, that's not possible. And she asked the commander about this, and he just sort of blew it off. So there were things like that that just didn't make sense.
Didn't sit well with you.
Right.
Oh, I want to invite our listeners to be part of the conversation, too. Listeners, if you've ever been conned, whether it was by a person who claimed to love you or a total stranger, call in and tell us, has it changed the way you think about lies and lying? Our number is 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. And if you want, tell us what you wish other people understood about your experience as the person who got duped. Give us a call, 212-433-9692. So, Abby, tell us, as the person sitting in front of me who you say you got conned.
The dupee,
let's call you. What do you wish other people understood about your experience? Because I think there is a certain level of judgment that gets passed.
Oh, I would not say certain. I would say humongous.
A high level of judgment.
Everybody really is interested in the perp. They want to know how they do it. How do people split their lives in two? How do you lie? Why do you lie? Where does this come from? Is it learned? Is it innate? Can anybody do this? And they look at the victims with scorn, with derision. They're stupid. How could they not have known? They're an idiot.
I think there's also a sense of like, oh, I would never.
It would never happen
that.
To me.
Right.
It would
right,
never
right.
happen to me. Meanwhile, the country at the moment is being deceived. I mean, and that's bipartisan because Republicans think they're being duped by the Democrats and the Democrats think they're being duped by the Republicans and everybody. So this is on everybody's minds right now, whether it's romantic or not. But I think that so really smart people get deceived and there's actually an argument to be made that smarter people get deceived because they think they won't. And so they're willing to give the benefit of the doubt, or like I did, they second guess themselves. This doesn't sit right, but maybe I'm just too suspicious because that's my day job. So I think also people don't realize that, there is kind of you. It's to our benefit not to see something. It is betrayal blindness. If you know that the person sitting next to you at work is stealing money and you need this job, you're not going to whistleblow. It's to your benefit not to see it. Same thing, if you have a partner and they have a family around the corner and you are relying on this person to take care of you and to pay your mortgages and whatever, you're not going to want to know this or you're going to put it down. So it's the I knew but I didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I came across. So I think it's that there's a lot of self-deception that goes on.
Yeah.
That's who we deceive the most, ourselves.
So you mentioned that it somehow has to do, it sometimes has to do with how smart a person thinks that they are.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe sometimes the people who think they're very smart do get duped more often. Are there other patterns that have emerged in you interviewing dupers and dupies, as we're calling them, in the type of people who either do the conning or get conned?
Con artists are really smart. And it's like they're using their superpowers for evil rather than good. I think of Frank Abagnale, right, who was Catch Me If You Can. when he now works, and he spent his career working with the FBI, and now he does a lot with elder fraud. So he is using an identity fraud. He is using his superpowers for good. He is helping people not get conned.
He has switched sides.
But, you know, they're really smart. They might even be a little bored. They want to create stories just to see what they can get away with. It's fun for them. That's a lot of the dupers. Mm. They're crafty. They are maybe bored. They're not always psychopaths.
Or malicious.
Well, they're not always. They're not always malicious. They're not always malicious. The psychopaths are lacking in empathy, so they don't really care what happens what the fallout is from their lives. But I think dupes, as I said, really have incentive to look the other way because they're lonely. Because if it's a romantic relationship, because they want love, because they need this person to be in their life, because they want this person to be in their life. But then there's other scenarios. If it's work, if it's just, it depends. But we are willfully blind.
My guest is Abby Ellen. She's the author of a new book, Duped: Double Lives, False Identities, and The Con Man I Almost Married. We're taking some calls, Abby. Catherine in Brooklyn is calling in. Hi, Catherine. You're on WNYC. What's your story?
Hi. When I was 20 years old, I was an actor. I went to an audition set up by my agent with a man named Michael DiPentino for a music video for Garbage, the band.
Oh, cool.
It was going to be a thriller-style, 12-minute-long music video. I got the part of the lesbian vampire, and I started started rehearsals. At the same time, the producer asked me to audition to star with Christopher Walken in a feature film. So it was about 6 months that I spent kind of in this person's realm. And then my father figured out that he was probably not who he said he was, because he couldn't find any information about him on the internet. And then my father pretended that he was a photographer that was being hired by Garbage and called around and basically found out that this guy was nobody.
Wow. Your dad loves you.
It's a very long story. It's hard to distill. But.
Your father and my mother.
Yeah, exactly.
Did they want you? Was he romantically interested in you too? Or was it purely
what was so hard for me and still is hard for me to figure out is that he never hit on me. I was alone in limos with him late at night. I mean, I spent my birthday with him when I turned 20, I think.
Wow.
And he never was inappropriate to me. He did kind of these benevolent acts for people at times. Like, this person was cut their foot at a club and he helped them pay for their medical bills, or he said he was anyway.
So what do you think he was? Do you think it was gross insecurity and he was trying to make himself seem better? Because that often happens too. They just want to make themselves seem better than they really are.
It was very, so he's in jail now for 305 years for mail fraud. It's the biggest white collar crime sentence, or it was at the time.
Then that explains what he was doing. Okay.
Yeah, he also impersonated a lawyer, I think, and a doctor at some point. I think it was a power thing, and I think he enjoyed the attention, but I don't really know. I've always wanted to ask him. He's in jail in Denver.
So write
Catherine,
him a note.
It sounds like there you go. As we know, you can write letters now to people in jail. They can write back to you. Catherine, do you feel like we've done some guessing around what was going through his mind, but have you done some self-reflection? What's going through your mind? How do you feel about having been on this end of the dupe?
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely come up a lot in my life because I inherently don't trust people who talk big games, I guess. For a while, I actually stopped acting after that for many years because I was like, how am I ever going to believe anybody again? And I couldn't even believe that people on TV knew they were on TV. It just made me question everything for a long time.
Wow.
That's what happens. It makes you second guess yourself. That's the biggest tragedy of this whole thing, I think, is that it just makes you just question everything about yourself. You were 20 years old. How could you have known?
Catherine, thank you so much for calling in. We're going to let you go. But Abby, I want to ask you something you said earlier. You said that we lie to ourselves.
Yes.
A whole lot.
Yes.
Even super low stakes lies, we lie to ourselves.
We have to. We have to lie to ourselves because if we wouldn't get out of bed otherwise. There are these simple life lies that we tell. Just to, you know, it's interesting because there have been studies done about athletes and how athletes kind of, professional athletes, Olympic level athletes, how the stories that they tell themselves to and how they get, motivate themselves and what they have to do. You know, it's the same kind of thing. I mean, we lie to ourselves and we trust that every time we go into an airplane, every time we go into a taxi, every time we go into a subway, we have to trust that it's going to be okay. And usually it is, but we don't know who's in charge. Just like we have to lie to ourselves that everything's okay and that, you know, we can lose that weight, we will get that job, we will meet that woman or man. We have to.
Can I ask you, has this experience changed the way that you lie, either to yourself or other people? Because we all lie. I'm just operating on that assumption.
We do. I'm a fan of little white lies, actually. I mean, I want you to tell me how good I look and how smart I sound and that you loved my book. I think that it has changed. I made a little log in the book of how many lies I tell. And I realize I mostly tell, you know, small lies. White lies. But I have a friend, and my close friends, I give them the absolute truth, and they give me the absolute truth. But I was wearing, had a pair of shoes, and I said to my friend, "What do you think?" And she said, "Yuck." And I thought, my first instinct was, really, must you? Can't you just lie to me? And then I thought, I asked for it. You respect me enough to give me the truth. I am obligated to take it. So, you know, I think there's a lot of knowing your audience.
Mm-hmm.
But I've always been really very honest with big stuff, and I still am. I think people deserve that. I think not knowing where you are and where you really sit in life, I think that's a terrible way to live, and it's unsettling and it's unmooring, and you know, I realize it's life, it happens, but I think everybody deserves to know where they stand.
Now that you've spoken to so many people on both sides of lying, do you think that there's an absolute worst question to ask someone who's been duped and a better way to maybe get at the same question?
Well, you know, my initial instinct is, God, why were you such an idiot? And, you know, I anticipate that still.
I'm thinking of people in my own life who, you know, get a fake call from the IRS or something and suddenly wire over an amount of money and then you say, oh, no, it was a lie.
Yeah, that was, yeah. You had people who did that, really?
Oh, yeah.
Wired money. When money gets involved, I mean, that's, my father almost had that. He got a request for money for my brother, except it wasn't my brother. They had manipulated the email. So, you know, that's a little different because that's, you don't expect to be lied to that degree. None of us expect to, but that's, you know, when you have like a parent whose child seems like they're in dire need of money, you want to help your child. So, you know, but I'd say the best thing to do is to not beat somebody up and don't make them feel stupid. They know how stupid they are.
I want to share a little detail that you've shared about when the cracks started to appear with the commander, just to end on a note with the commander.
Okay.
You said it wasn't so much all the big things, but it was Brussels sprouts.
Finally, something verifiable.
That sort of set off a red flag for
you. Yeah, we were out. I couldn't verify the CIA. I couldn't verify Navy SEAL until after the fact. Because he got arrested, you know. He went to jail. But we were out to dinner with my parents, and he raved about these Brussels sprouts. They were just fantastic. And my parents were pleased, but, you know, they didn't make them. They didn't care, really. And when we walked outside and left my folks, he said, God, that was one of the worst meals I ever had. And I said, you know, why did you have to rave about it? You could have said, this has been lovely, thank you. He said, I was trying to make them feel good. And I thought, you know, if he could lie about something so inconsequential, he can lie about anything.
So maybe look out for the Brussels sprouts.
The Brussels sprout
red
test.
Flags in your life.
Yeah.
Abby Ellen, thank you so much for coming
into
our studio. Abby's book is called Duped, Double Lives, False Identities, and the Con Man I Almost Married. It's available now. Abby, thanks for being on All of It.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with our colleague, Clemency Burton Hill, and her classical music picks of the week. Much more coming after the break. You're listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Shamita Basu from the WNYC Newsroom and for Allison Stewart. Now is the time of the week in the show where we slow it down and listen to a few classical music compositions with our colleague, Clebency Burton Hill. She is WQXR's creative director for music and arts, and she has a new book out called Year of Wonder, Classical Music to Enjoy Day by Day. It's what it sounds like. It's a collection of songs and compositions, one for each day of the year, with an accompanying anecdote or a backstory for every piece. Last week, we heard from Bach and Schubert. Clemency, welcome back to All of It.
Thank you so much. How lovely to see you.
It's so nice to see you here, too. So tell us what you have for us this week. You like to pick three different dates. What are we starting with?
Well, we start with the piece that I chose for the 16th of January, and it's totally cheating. You just said that each day of the year, I provide a little context or backstory, and ordinarily that is the case.
I was going to say something.
I might tell you a bit about the composer or perhaps the circumstances of the composition. I really try to not only demystify the music, but also humanize the people who wrote the music and created it. This one, though, middle of January. Are we all feeling middle of January-ish?
Absolutely.
I certainly am. So with apologies to non-drinkers or anyone attempting a dry January, for this piece, I say, you know what? Sometimes what we really need in the middle of this month is music that feels like a large glass of red wine. That is as expert as this context gets. It's a piece by Alexander Scriabin, who is a Russian composer, an etude in C-sharp minor. He was really very influential in his lifetime, but very quickly forgotten. He was also much influenced by Chopin, who's a very famous composer for piano work. So you can definitely hear that influence there. But I just happen to really love this etude. And if, like me, you're definitely feeling like this is a Monday in mid-January, hopefully this will provide a little sonic tonic.
What you mean, Clemmy? It is like it has a warming effect to it. It is like a big old glass of red wine.
Yeah, and if you need a little mental respite, I find that music like this really delivers. I'm also fascinated. We talk a lot about colours in music, mm-hmm. and you know, sometimes that can feel rather abstract. But I'm fascinated by the fact that he really was a composer who was very influenced by colour. He had synesthesia, and he associated colours with the various harmonic tones of his atonal scale, which he developed. So he's a really interesting composer and probably deserves more context than just it sounds like a glass of wine. But every now and again, I think it's important with classical music to just be like, you know, if this delivers something to you and it's what you need at that given moment and that's how you respond to it, that's also fine.
Then take it. Then take
exactly.
it.
Take it.
Take us to our second day of this week that you've chosen.
So I chose an oboe concerto by a Baroque composer called Tommaso Albinoni, who was born in 1671. I wanted to single out and show a little bit of love for the oboe, because if you've ever been to an orchestral concert, then you'll have heard this one note that sounds at the beginning before the rest of the orchestra tune up.
Mm-hmm.
And that for me has always been quite a magical moment. There's a sort of, you know, shivers go up my spine or goosebumps or whatever, because it's sort of, you know, the promise of what might be about to ensue. So he occupies, or she, I don't know if the oboe is female, probably, quite a privileged position in the orchestral gang. It will sound that perfect A, and it's that clarity of notes, which I think composers have been long drawn to. The oboes descended from the sorts of pipes that have been used really by shepherds and the like for centuries. And they have that rather kind of pastoral sound that comes through blowing air through a double reed. But they can also be the height of modern technology, which was what they were when Albinoni was writing. He was one of the very, very first composers who realised that this instrument, this, you know, descended from the most humble of pipes, could actually potentially do really phenomenal things musically. So this was one of the very first solo oboe concertos, and it was hugely influential and been influencing very famous composers like J.S. Bach. So this is the second movement of the oboe concerto in D minor. ¶¶
That's lovely. I feel like I'm looking out over rolling hills when I'm listening to that. The pastoral effect you're saying is really true.
Effect. I mean, you can definitely see some shepherds, maybe rolling hills in the distance.
So that was the first to ever really highlight the beauty of the oboe, you're saying?
Yeah, he wrote the first ever concerto for solo oboe. At least the one that survives. It's possible that some might have written, but certainly he was really the first composer to recognise the power of that instrument and run with it. He went on to write at least seven more, and as I say, was very influential for other composers who would go on to write really beautifully for the oboe. So oboists certainly have a lot to thank Albinoni for.
So take us through a third day, January 19th, right, you've chosen, which is a bit more modern.
Yeah, this one brings us right up to at least the 20th century. I love the idea. There was Albinoni writing for real modern technology of the day. It might sound rather ancient to us, but it was very much cutting edge. And speaking of the cutting edge, the American composer Steve Reich is always there. He was born in 1936. I'm very happy to say that he is still with us, still being a great pioneer when it comes to musical language. And he always has been. He's very much a playful wit when it comes to music as well. He's credited with founding American minimalism, or at least being one of the key pillars of American minimalism, along with people like Philip Glass and John Adams. Mm. And that tends to be music that is symbolised by kind of repeating patterns, driving rhythms, shape-shifting melodies. I find his rhythmic capabilities are just absolutely mesmerising, and I find that Steve Reich's music, if I need a sort of mental clarification, if I need something to just kind of get me in the zone, then it always delivers. So let's have a little listen to this. This is the first movement of his piece called Electric Counterpoint.
Why you've chosen Steve Reich for January 19th?
Well, there's actually no real reason why it had to come on the 19th of January.
It's sort of the same as the glass of wine effect,
yeah,
is that what it is?
I hasten to add that throughout the book, wherever possible, I wanted there to be a compelling reason for you to be listening to that particular piece on that particular day. And so sometimes that correlates to a date or a birthday or an anniversary or something that happened in history, something to put it into context and remind us that there is this ongoing continuum between these often, you know, dead composers. You know, we so often think of classical music as being this sort of dead, invariably white male museum piece, and I really passionately believe that it is an alive form. It is evolving and diverse and thrilling all the time. So I wanted to make sure that also, if you were listening along and you had the playlists and you just sort of hit play, then it would work musically to hear one thing to the next. And I was programming it very much like I would program a radio program in that sense. So there wasn't a particular reason for hearing on the 19th of January on this occasion, but I do find it a supreme mood booster. And again, connected to Scriabin's glass of wine, maybe this is a bit more of a morning one. Consider it this, you know, your shot of espresso without any of the downsides of too much caffeine.
Yes. Well, while I understand completely the way that you've organized this book and how often these dates correlate with something, as you said, in the story of the composer or the piece of music, how do you decide, just you yourself as a person who loves listening to this music, in the morning, what is it that's going to be the first thing that you listen to that day?
Yeah, I feel so lucky that because I've been steeped in this music all my life, I usually do have the right thing to just turn to. And it's a continuing sense of wonderment for me that classical music, you know, we're talking almost a millennium's worth of music. Whatever my mood is, whatever my need is, whatever I require spiritually on that morning, I invariably can turn to the thing and know that it will deliver that. But what I also love about this art form is just surprise and serendipity. So I'm always on a journey as well, and I'm always on a mission to find new pieces of classical music, composers I don't know so well. So listeners, if you have ideas for me, please get in touch.
How can they get in touch with you?
You can tweet me at ClementCBH. You could there's all sorts of ways you could find me. Probably Twitter's the easiest one to do. So Instagram at ClementCBH as well, or through the All of It contact details. But I love hearing suggestions from listeners all the time and from readers as well. You know, I've been lucky enough to have a lot of classical music in my life, but there's always new adventures to go on. And that's sort of what I want to do with the book, is extend a hand and say, come on this great grand sonic adventure with me through the year.
So if you want to join Clemency and you're not sure how else to find her, you can also tweet at All of It WNYC. We'll make sure that those notes get passed along to her. Clemmy, thank you as always for joining us.
Thank you so much. Lovely to see you.
You too. Coming up next on All of It, we'll catch up with Afrofuturist funk band, the Illustrious Blacks. Stay with us. My next guests are here in the studio with me. Manchild Black and Monsta Black are a Brooklyn-based duo. Together they are called...
The Illustrious Blacks.
I knew you'd jump in if I gave you the opportunity. Well, their celestial Afrofuturist queer pop music is described in a little story, a fable, on their website, which I want to read for you now. In a galaxy not far away, there lived two kings. Each was the ruler of his own deliciously glorious planet. The first king, Manchild Black, was well known throughout the cosmos for his ethereal vocals, celestial sonics, and earthy musical messages. Mm. The other king, Monsta Black, was a star in the solar system for his gravity-defying performances, gender-bending fashions, and spacey disposition. Mm. One magical night, an inexplicable ultramagnetic pull forced the two planets to collide. A technicolored explosion occurred, turning night into day with a feast of oral and visual delights.
Yes.
It was then that the universe was changed forever. Manchild Black and Monsta Black united and became the Illustrious Blacks.
Wow. Oh. You did that so well.
Oh, well, I couldn't have done it without all the backup sound effects. So thank you very much. Let's throw to a real sound effect. I want people to hear one of your songs.
Okay.
Come inside my spaceship. We'll fly into orbit. You don't need no ticket. If love is in your heart, this is where it starts.
People of the world,
get up, get up.
All the boys and the girls,
get up, get up.
If you're black or you're white,
get up, get up.
If you feel all right,
get up, get up.
Bi or straight,
get up, get up.
Trans or gay.
Manchild Black, Monsta Black, the two of you, welcome to All of It.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you for having us.
Of
we are honored to be here.
Well, thank you for coming into the studio. There's so much that I want to talk to you about. Everything from your music to your costumes to your performance to your social commentary.
Uh-oh.
So let's start with the music first. Let's break it apart, right? Describe what concepts, what genres, what influences you are thinking about when you're making music.
Oh, wow. Well, there's definitely a dance music influence. There's a lot of funk and a lot of soul that's influencing as well. And I would have to say that there's a little bit of a punk edge that slides in as well. Wouldn't you say that, Manchild?
Definitely. Well, we met on the dance floor, the two of us, many years ago. Well, not too long ago, but many years ago. And we met dancing to club music. Mm-hmm. And so it's
was
funny.
That here in New York?
No.
That was in Washington, D.C.
In D.C.
A far-off planet.
Yes.
Washington, D.C. And we literally met on the dance floor dancing to club music. And so that's filtered its way into our lives and our professional lives.
Yes.
Yeah.
Because you are not only creative partners, you're also married.
We are married. Yes.
So talk a little bit about that. How does your partnership inform your work?
Well, we waited a while before we actually started working together. Like, we dabbled in doing some small performances and parties earlier in our relationship, but we realized that we should take it slow because working together and being together in a partnership, a married relationship, is not always the easiest thing. We've had plenty of examples in the entertainment industry to, you know,
To go by. Yeah. He's right. We waited because we both come from different worlds creatively. I had a theater background.
And this is Man-Child speaking right now.
This is Man-Child
speaking.
Just so it
doesn't get confusing for our listeners.
Yes. I have the low sexy voice.
Right. Mine is lower.
No, we came from two different creative backgrounds. I come from theater and Monsta comes from the dance world. And so we both come to projects differently. We approach things differently. So we had to kind of learn how to maneuver and how to work together and come strike a balance, I guess.
Yeah. So tell me about some of the different elements that you marry in your performances.
Well, there is the element of performance art that's in there. And also there's a lot of spectacle, which, you know, is obviously inspired by artists like Prince, David Bowie, Ziggy Stardust, Parliament Funkadelic, Grace Jones is another huge influence, with the idea of just the image being a really important part of the stage performance.
And also, I mean, something similar in a lot of those artists you just named was an androgynous sort of look.
Androgyny,
as well.
Androgyny. And I would have to say that the androgynous element that they had was a huge inspiration for me growing up, to the point where I feel like, in a sense, it kind of saved my life because I was able to really use their inspiration as an outlet to find happiness within my own existence and accepting myself because of what they were doing.
It sounds like, Monsta, that you're saying you didn't have a whole lot of idols in your accessible life to look to in that way?
Well, they were all on MTV.
Yeah. You couldn't touch them, but they were just on the other side of the screen.
Yeah, exactly.
There you go.
Exactly.
I hear you.
And I had also, and I was encouraged by my family to just go for it. You know, I was never held back. You know, my creative expression, I was pushed to express myself creatively, really.
Can you describe, either of you or both of you, how you're engaging with Afrofuturism? Because I think that for some people, maybe they're thinking about Afrofuturism in a Black Panther sense, or this was the most recent sort of pop culture something for them to pin it to.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a rich history of thinkers on this. So tell me how you're engaging with that dialogue.
Well, we think of Afrofuturism as this. Afrofuturism for us is really about Black liberation.
Mm.
And so we felt that there was an absence, and sometimes just in our culture, there's an absence of the queer aspect of that. You know, sometimes Black liberation looks different to different people. And we wanted to make sure that LGBTQ people are included in that liberation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when you say Black, sometimes Blackness means a very specific thing to specific people, and a lot of times that's very cis heteronormative.
Right.
And so we're here to say, hey, we're here too, and we deserve liberation as well.
And Black joy. We're all about Black joy.
And Black fun.
Black fun.
Black joy, Black fun. Yeah. Your work, as you said, definitely deals with issues of queer Black love.
Mm-hmm.
Truly.
Tell me what got you here. I mean, what drives you to make this art right now?
Wow, what drives me? I feel like I've always been driven by...
And this is Monsta.
This is Monsta Black.
Don't lower your voice now.
Yes, I've been... I think that it's all sparked from my childhood, really. You know, I'm driven by the need to really find empowerment in my creativity that basically stands up against the bullying that I endured as a child. And so, you know, and I started at a pretty early age of saying, oh, okay, so you think I look like a girl? You think I sound like a girl? Well, this is what I am like when I really allow that to flourish. And so I allowed that to just pretty much, you know, become my the driving force behind things that I've created from like a very early age.
Right. And we also want to, you know, examine why those things are so are deemed negative in our society. So if you're a man and you might look a little androgynous, that's a problem. What's the problem with that? I think we have to open up the what it means to be a man or a woman and in this society. And
yeah, and I do feel like we've come a long way, but then there are things that happen today that make us feel like, oh my God, we just took like 10 steps
what
backwards.
What year is it? Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. We're constantly in this year asking, what year is this really? And exactly. It just turned 2019.
We're only 14 days in, I hate
right,
to say it.
Right.
Well, now, so this is radio, so we're going to have to be really descriptive here.
Okay.
Because I want our listeners to understand that your costumes are very much part of your performance.
Mm-hmm,
can you talk about your, I wish they could see your outfits today, by the way. We'll take a picture maybe outside after the show and tweet it. But can you talk about how your costumes speak to the issues in your music and your performance?
How the costumes speak to the issues.
Well, once again, it's really about freedom and liberation.
Right.
We draw a lot of influence from costume-wise and visually from the 70s and 80s periods,
right.
And as well as the 90s.
Right.
But particularly the 70s with the whole like disco kind right. of vibe.
Spandex, Lycra.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We didn't get to go to Studio 54 or Paradise Garage. We were not of age. Right. But, you know, we wished, you know.
Yeah.
And so we're kind of living that through our creative and our aesthetics now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you say?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to play another one of your songs. This
okay.
one is called Black Like Jesus. So that's Black Like Jesus
yes,
with
is.
My guests, the illustrious Blacks. I want to talk a little bit about how this song opens, which we didn't play just now, but it opens with a sample of Philando Castile's mother's voice.
Mm-hmm.
This is after the Minnesota police officer who killed her son was acquitted of all charges.
Right.
And his mother says, my son loved this city and the city killed my son. It is, I got goosebumps just reading that, is such a charged recording. It's you can hear the hurt in her
yes.
voice.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And you use it at the beginning of this song, which launches into such energy and such joy. Why did you sample her voice that way? And describe for me a little the tension that you create in your work.
Oh, well, this is Man-Child, by the way. we heard that speech for the first time when she delivered it. We were doing a show in
Providence,
Rhode Island. And it came over the news that the gentleman was acquitted. And she gave that impassioned speech. And I just couldn't let it go, you know. I thought she captured not only, of course, what she was feeling, but what we were feeling sitting mm-hmm. there, you know, just every aspect of it.
Right.
And so we had to perform that night, and we performed, and one of the songs we performed is Black Like Jesus, and we just thought, I don't know, somehow we have to this feeling, this pain, we need to transform it into something
mm-hmm.
that we can use within our show. And so we didn't sample it on the single
night.
Itself, but we use it in the video. We had a wonderful director, Stephen Winter, who had seen our live show, and we had mm-hmm. put it in the live show to set the pace for Black Like Jesus, the mm-hmm. song. And so he was moved by that and thought, you know, that should be the springboard also for the music
video.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
How do you want people to feel when they're watching you perform or listening to your music?
Wow. When they're watching us perform, I feel like there's a series of emotions that people go through. But ultimately, there's joy and happiness, but there's moments of like sadness and just like deep thought, and it's like an emotional roller coaster.
It seems like an emotional dance party, frankly. Yeah, it's all very. I've seen some videos too of your performances, and everyone is dancing, emotional. And there's joy. But describe to me the sadness that's also experienced.
Well, there's that moment, like you just mentioned, the Castile, where people are actually sitting there and they have the moment to just like that's. The speech is the main thing that's happening, and there's just stillness. So you have to actually sit with that and listen to what's happening after coming off of this whole like joy ride before it, you know, and then you're in the midst of that and we're on stage representing, you know, joy and happiness, but also representing two black males who are married to each other. So there's all that comes into play. But then by the end of the show, there's like an enlightenment, like another joy of just like everyone kind of like coming into the space, sitting inside of all their emotional experience that they've had together and realizing that we're, you know, we just need to basically celebrate each other and humanity and in a sense get over ourselves sometimes. Like, we're all underneath of our skin, you know, we all bleed red.
And the thing is also that we want people to leave differently than they came. You know, we don't want you, if you're in a difficult place, a sunken place,
some might say,
you know, you don't have to stay there. We're hoping that our work transforms people and empowers people to make changes, not only in their individual lives, but in this society and how they treat others and how they think about things.
I am going to squeeze in one last song just because I want people to hear this one. This is Revolutionary Love.
Sometimes the world gets me down and
so we're almost out of time here, but tell us a little bit about this song. I know, I wish we weren't. Tell us a little bit about this song and, of course, this music video.
Well, oh, wow, the music video. Okay, real quick.
This is Manchild.
Right, hey, this is Manchild. We wanted to make something. We hadn't done a single or a song that was really about our love and how, not only about our love, but how our love is perceived in the world. And so we wanted to create something that spoke to that. With the music video, which is very intimate, we we have a moment in our show where there's a big kiss. And so, there's a big kiss. And so we thought this would be the perfect video in which to reenact that moment in the show.
So the music video is you two kissing. Almost the entire entire music
pretty
video.
Pretty much. And our friend Fabu Man directed that, and we're very grateful.
You can check out The Illustrious Blacks on Spotify and wherever else you listen to your music. Are you two playing anywhere live?
Well, right now we have some DJ parties coming up, but live we're getting ready to go on tour in mid-February to mid-March, Asia, Australia, New Zealand. And then we'll be back with some full shows, but then keep in touch with us on Instagram and Facebook.
Yeah. Follow them on social. That's it for our show. Thanks for listening to All of It on WNYC. I'm Shamitha Basu. All of It is produced by Megan Ryan, Rosie Guerin, Catherine Millsop, Andres O'Hara, Ursula Sommer, Simon Close, Jordan Lauf, and Pilar Belendez de Shea. Matt Mirando is our engineer. Thanks, Matt. And Luscious Jackson does our theme music. You can follow All of It on Instagram and Twitter at All of It WNYC. And of course, join us weekdays at noon here at WNYC. I'm Shamitha Basu. Allison Stewart is back tomorrow. Thanks for listening.
WNYC is supported by